Welcome to the University of Limerick Research Impact Podcast Series. I'm Christine Brennan. How important is protein in your diet? Well, research at the University of Limerick has found out that protein intake becomes even more important as we age, as it can have an impact on the loss of muscle mass. To tell us more about this research, I'm joined by Professor Phil Jakeman and Dr. Catherine Norton. Phil is the Professor of Sport and Exercise Sciences and a Foundation Fellow of the Centre for Interventions in Infection, Inflammation and Immunity, 4i, and the Health Research Institute at the University of Limerick. Catherine is a lecturer in sports and exercise nutrition at the Department of Physical Education and Sports Sciences, and she's also a member of the Health Research Institute. So Phil, can I start with you? What do you mean by age-related muscle mass loss?
If I start to explain that from birth, we go through several phases of growth and maturation to a point where we reach adulthood. At that point, we start to decline. In terms of muscle mass, this follows a similar trend. The trend in muscle mass peaks somewhere around the age of 40 years of age. And that's quite young, really, to think that you see a decline from the age of 40 to 45. We know this because we've undertaken a study over the last 10 years called the UL Body Composition Study. Within this study, we've recruited about 3,000 volunteers from the campus community and also from the Limerick environs. That has led us to be able to map out the changes over the lifespan, the complete lifespan from 18 to 82 years of age. From this, we find that the decline in tissue mass from the age of 40 occurs at about 0.6 kilos, that's 1% of the total lean tissue mass in an adult man, and about 0.4 kilos, again about 1% of the average woman. Now, that's quite significant to the health of the individual. I liken this to the change we observe in lean tissue mass or muscle mass as a silent disease. It's rather like the change you see in bone. You don't perceive this to be true. You don't know it's happening to you, but it's happening in a silent way. Of course, when challenged, the loss in bone mass leads to fracture. That would be the outcome. When challenged, the loss in muscle mass, which is known as sarcopenia, can be equally disabling.
So, Phil, what is the impact of this condition for individuals and indeed for our health service?
For the individual, the impact is almost imperceptible until you reach a time where you probably can't undertake the same level of daily activity that you'd like to. I mean, a classic example from research would show that women, for instance, over 55 years of age, two-thirds of them can no longer lift a 10-kilo suitcase luggage into the overhead locker in an aeroplane, for instance. So that's really quite disabling. That's probably when you'd notice these things. Others might find that they no longer able to pick up and swing around the grandchildren, for instance. Those would be the perceptible things of the loss of lean tissue mass. Later in life, of course, the loss of lean tissue mass can be cripplingly disabled. This is what leads to frailty. And the demographic trends the way they are in Ireland at the moment, it seems like this is a burden that's going to increase rather than decrease. So best to intervene early. So muscle is often perceived as something which enables movement, and quite rightly too. But muscle is also an organ. It's a very large organ. It's probably the largest organ we have in the body, occupying maybe 60% of the total body mass. And that organ functions in many ways, not just in movement. It actually is the major repository for glucose. That means that the carbohydrate that we consume has to go somewhere and is taken up by the muscle. And if that fails, that repository fails because we actually lose that muscle tissue, then we are unable to regulate blood glucose. And that leads to all the metabolic diseases, which is conditional to the diabetic, for instance. That would be the diabetic condition. So the preservation from lean tissue mass from that point of view is very, very important indeed. Muscle is also, of course, a major organ that metabolizes fat. In fact, the more muscle you have, the greater ability you have to actually metabolize fat. Muscle as an organ has tenfold the metabolic activity of fat. And therefore, the more muscle we have, the greater the overall metabolic rate. So in a phase now that we have in the country where we have over excessive nutrient intake, muscle is very important in the disposal of that nutrient intake. And if we gradually decline that, we gradually decline our ability to actually utilize that. Of course, if we don't do that, then excess intake is probably going to be deposited as fat. And that leads again to all the metabolic diseases and the related to obesity. It's important to note that when you mature at the age of 40, you probably have a ratio of about 4-1 in lean tissue to fat mass. But with the age-related decline in muscle mass and the age-related increase in fat mass, at age 60, the same individual probably has a ratio of about 2-1. And that is where the problem lies. I have to also state that we now know a lot about the muscle crosstalk, the crosstalk between muscle and other organs. In this case, we now know that muscle is very much implicated in immunity. It's implicated directly to bone. And even the recent research suggests that muscle can have an impact on brain function, metabolic health, and therefore cognitive function. I sum this as, you know, use it or lose it. In the cost to society and the health service in Ireland of age-related loss of muscle mass, sarcopenia as we know it, the British Medical Journal recently reported that there's a prevalence in the UK of about 9 to 18% of people over the age of 65. In recognition of the serious health consequences, frailty, disability, mobility, mortality, age-related loss of muscle mass in the United States was estimated at $14.2 billion. That was the cost, the direct cost, about 1.5% of the total healthcare expenditure for that year. Similar projections can be made now for Ireland's aging population, and is clearly something we should attend to early.
Great. So clearly this issue, Phil, has huge impacts. And Catherine, can I bring you in here? How is your research tackling the issue?
The research that we conducted was carried out in a number of phases. Phil already mentioned there the body composition study. That was our starting point, really, to try and look and see exactly what people were made of. So with the technology that we use in our research, we can see how much of an individual is lean tissue mass or how much is bone. So using the UL body composition study, we were able to recruit people who were pre-sarcopenic. We didn't want to intervene with people who were very frail, very old, people who were already disabled. We were looking to keep healthy people healthy. So from the local community, we were able to recruit people from the age of 50 to 70. My starting point with the nutrition intervention was to assess how adequate their diets were to begin with. We know that there are two major stimulus for increasing or maintaining lean tissue mass. One would be physical activity, but in this domain, what we were looking to intervene with was nutrition. What I wanted to figure out was, how was their nutrition to begin with? If we were recruiting local people who were just normal individuals from 50 to 70, was their intake adequate? So we began by trying to characterise what their intakes were for energy and protein. Now, the current recommendations for protein are set on a per day basis. So most people eat food, they don't eat nutrients, they don't eat grams of protein. So it's very difficult for the non-educated in nutrition person to interpret whether or not their protein intakes are adequate. We began by looking to see whether or not people had sufficient protein to meet the current recommendations. And of the 178 people we began with, 99% of them had protein sufficiency. So according to the recommendations which are currently set, they had adequate amounts of protein in their diet. From other research that's been carried out by our group in the university, we know that there are nuances to protein intake, and looking specifically just at absolute amounts really isn't sufficient. So we were investigating the timing of protein intake and the quality of the protein that was being consumed across the course of the day. So what this involved for the participants was that they kept food diaries over 4-day duration, where they were asked to chart every single item of food or drink or supplements or medication that they consumed. And this allowed our research team to categorise and to characterise their nutrient intakes over the course of the 4 days. And if anyone listening wants to consider how they currently eat, if you consider what you might have had for your breakfast this morning, mine was oats and fruit, not too much protein there, and that was pretty representative of how the population who were recruited to our study currently eat. The protein intake in a typical breakfast for our population did not meet the requirements that we would need to switch on the mechanisms of muscle protein synthesis. And moving on to lunch, the typical lunch that was consumed by our participants was maybe a sandwich and soup or a salad. Again, some protein there, but not sufficient amounts to switch on muscle protein synthesis. And in the traditional pattern of intake that Irish people tend to have, a large portion of protein comes with your evening meal, with your meat, potatoes and vegetables. So your chicken, your steak, whatever, your salmon was contributing quite a large amount of protein. But what we really wanted to focus on was whether or not, if we redistributed this protein, could we affect a change in how muscle protein synthesis occurs or how frequently you could switch it on. So that was the main focus of the research. to come back to a point that I made earlier when I referenced how people consume food and not nutrients, if we're knowledgeable now of how people's intakes, the distribution of protein, is insufficient, it would be very difficult for an average 50 to 70-year-old who doesn't have a nutrition qualification to address these changes in a way that they would be able to correct, while they're sufficient in amount, the suboptimal distribution of this protein. So what we wanted to do first was a proof of concept. So we worked with industry to devise a supplement which would be taken at the two smaller meals over the course of the day for these population, the 50 to 70-year-old group. And I think it's important to state again here that these were healthy, free-living, community-based people who didn't have any pre-existing medical conditions, but who had suboptimal distribution of their protein. So working with industry, we devised a protein which these participants took at their two smaller meals in the day, at breakfast and at lunch. And by doing so, we didn't change the overall amount of protein that they were consuming, but just how it was distributed. And this was the direct cause of the loss of lean tissue mass, which we observed, or in some cases, the increase in lean tissue mass, which we managed to achieve.
Sorry, Catherine, can I ask you, is there any variance on the type of protein itself, whether it was plant-based or animal-based?
There were vegans and vegetarians in the group. We didn't disclude people who had those types of food preferences because it was part of the investigation that we wanted to assess. So there would be huge variance in the way that people consume protein. But again, coming back to the knowledge that we would have from previous research, the most valuable protein in terms of muscle protein accrual to consume would be that which is animal source. And in particular, we know that dairy proteins have a high bioactivity in this regard. With the population that we had, they were divided into a group who either received a protein supplement or people who received a control supplement. And we had 60 individuals, 30 in each group, who we followed through for 6 months. And the outcome measure that we were assessing was the change in lean tissue mass measured by DEXA. And traditionally, people would associate DEXA with osteopenia or osteoporosis. And this population were very familiar with having had DEXA scans completed to assess whether or not they were at risk for either of those conditions. But they were not aware that you could also use the same technology to check for lean tissue mass. So this was something new that they were learning from it. And as we progressed from the baseline to 3 months to 6 months in the intervention, anecdotally, people were reporting that they felt better, that it was easier, as Phil mentioned earlier on, to lift their grandchildren or to carry in a bucket of coal from the back garden. And what we really wanted to see was not only could we assess the change in lean tissue mass using DEXA, but whether or not people had functional outcomes that improved. So we did see changes in lean tissue mass where the people who received the control supplement had the decline, which we would have anticipated over the 6 months, and those who received the protein supplement had an increase in lean tissue mass. Hand in hand with that, they were also reporting and showing in the physical assessments which we carried out, improvements in their activities of daily living. So how quickly they could walk, how easy it was for them to get up and down from a chair, and the kind of reports the research team were getting back were along the lines of holding grandchildren or carrying shopping or performance on the golf course, the kind of things that that population are concerned with. We had a population of 60 to begin with. Well, we actually had a population of 180 who were recruited, and a number were screened out for different reasons or weren't able to participate. So our baseline population who were going to undertake the 6 month study was a group of 60. And these were divided into a protein group, those who were receiving the protein supplement, and those who were receiving a control substance. And the control substance was carbohydrate. Obviously, we didn't want our participants to know that they were receiving the placebo, the dummy substance. So we had a lot of conversations from those who were knowledgeable. Perhaps they had sons who were in the gym, or maybe they just knew a little bit about protein. And they were asking us which one was the protein. Was it the cloudy one or the clear one? So we were giving them advice on how they were both proteins. One was just cloudier than the other. Because it's a topical area and people are interested in it, it became evident as we progressed that people were knowledgeable as to what protein would look like. But the control substance was a carbohydrate, the same calorie content as the protein.
So looking at the overall impact of this study, can I ask you, Phil, what has the impact of it been, or the potential impact of the research?
I consider a key impact was firstly the identification that the loss of lean tissue mass occurs quite early in life. I don't think we really understood that before. And clearly that would be the time to intervene. And I think Catherine's outlined that keeping healthy people healthy is economically and obviously societally a much better approach than attending to that condition when it's gone to the frailty issue. Equally, I think we've now gained a better knowledge of how people actually eat and what the bioactive components in that food and how they should be timed appropriately, fed appropriately to best effect. This was unknown before. So I think this has opened up a new avenue of exploration. And also from the public health perspective, I think Catherine's very well placed as a senior executive in the Irish Nutrition and Dietetics Association Institute to drive those changes forward in the public domain. So very, very impactful from that point of view. Of course, we as a university, we provide the knowledge base which allows people to have informed choice. So we would hope that the impact of our work would be able to inform the choice of the individual and gives guidance as to how they can make those changes for themselves without having to have a degree in dietetics to do so. So I think that's an important impact. In the research domain, I think the key impact was the recognition of our peers of the study that was published in one of the world's leading nutrition journals. That was the Journal of Nutrition. In their press statement, their press alert, they found this to be a very impressive change in behaviour and change in outcome, i.e. change in lean tissue mass, just purely from a dietary perspective. And this held hope for those people who don't necessarily always want to do everything through exercise. It was quite a breakthrough from that. Of course, we were able to show that the National Technology Centre, Food for Health Ireland, was able to, through discovery, through high-calibre research, identify bioactives in proteins and to appropriately administer those, firstly into sort of cell culture lines, bring it through a test bed of a cohort of subjects, and then onto a clinical trial. And the conduct of that clinical trial, and Catherine was very conservative in her estimate there, she was the lead researcher, as a student researcher in those days, and it took 4 years to complete. So clearly, well played, great credit to the team for actually bringing that about. Because it's been taken and undertaken in the community. It's been undertaken in the community around Limerick. So that's an impactful translation of our cell-based research into society. We call that a cell-to-society sort of transition. In the enterprise culture that we live in, the Food for Health Ireland is there to actually promote the R&D activities of key major industries. In this particular case, it was the dairy industry. The impact of our work through that is that we have submitted this for patent. We have approval in principle that the patent has innovative step and that it has clearly demonstrated in the area of sarcopenia, the age-related loss of lean tissue mass, to be effective and therefore is patentable. The licensed activity from that will benefit, obviously, those companies who wish to use it and also license for further exploration, and we would truly hope that'll go forward. That, again, is one of the aspects of the university, which I think it drives great credit. You know, in the public domain, I think we've done a lot of good locally. You know, recruiting from 3,000 local people has involved and engaged the community in our work. And, of course, this spreads because every person is talking to another person. If I just reflect on the initial recruitment, it started in this building in the White House, and there were 38 people who attended a call. By the end of the week, as Catherine will confirm, we had 350 people already sort of volunteering to take part. And that's been sort of the way that things have progressed from there. So I think it's done a wide, good basis of work inside the community.
So I think from the perspective of the influence that we've had, one from my point of view would be in the dietetics domain. We've gone to great lengths to try and interact with the dietetic community. My peers, I'm a registered dietitian, to try and spread the good word, I suppose, that usually when assessments of dietary intake are being carried out, it would just be to say, have you reached the amount of protein which the recommendation sets as appropriate for you? And trying to get the word out there that the way that this protein is distributed, the source of the protein, as you mentioned, whether it's plant or animal, the quality of the protein are all very important considerations that need to be addressed as well. So we've interacted with the Irish Nutrition and Dietetic Institute to try and do some seminars and education for dietitians on this point. And we've also engaged with Sheila Barras, who's the head of the dietetic department in the University Hospital in Limerick, and her team to try and ensure that when they're using the translational aspect of our research to practice, that they have the right information to hand. Another important consideration, I think, is, as Phil mentioned, that we had a large number who were recruited from the university, whether they were ex-employees or alumni, and from the local community to UL. I would frequently meet those same people and they would come up to me in the street and say, I'm still following the same dietary advice that I put in place when we were part of the study. And as Phil alluded to, they're sharing this information with their friends on the golf course or in the British Society. So still now I would get phone calls to say, a friend of mine was involved in a study, she found it very beneficial, can I come in and be involved? And that's, from a research point of view, extremely rewarding, because all too often you see, you know, the science bench and the cells, but you don't actually get to see the people who benefit from it on the other side.
So can I ask you both about the future discovery? Where to from here?
There's a phrase coined that we don't just eat to live, we don't just live to eat. And I think that sort of reflects on how we're currently approaching our studies. Within our research group, we're very privileged, of course. We have a 5-year program grant, so we can extend our activities on a roll-on program funding. And that gives us great license to go forward. Our particular expertise, I think, is, if you haven't already gathered, is that we don't think that nutrition should act alone. We live in by our behaviours whereby physical activity is being promoted as a major part of our life. And what we've observed and what we've studied over the last decade is the interaction between physical activity and nutrients. Not only the nutrient quality, as has been demonstrated through this study, the timing of the nutrient intake and the timing of the nutrient intake in relation to physical activity. And there are several examples now where that has proved to be most beneficial, most augmentative. In the case we have here, we did a subsequent study to what Catherine's already described, and we enrolled a separate cohort on a physical activity program, not a mild physical activity program. These were not exactly exercise, habitually exercising type of people. And just the timing of the exercise in relation to the supplement that we gave increased the gain in lean tissue mass by a further 50%. So in the original gains, we were getting about, on average, about half to 0.6 of a kilo gain in lean tissue mass. The augmentation through physical activity, just introducing that alone, made this about 0.9 of a kilo. Now that is just about the same as you would lose per annum in age-related decline, as we call age-related sarcopenia. So that's very encouraging. So the combination of physical activity and nutrient intake is greater than any single of those alone. Of course, muscle is connected to bone. And we always think of bone. I'm sure a lot of the listeners here would be talking about osteopenia and osteoporosis. That is a crippling disease, absolutely crippling. And normally measured by bone mineral density, which is what all our subjects were also pre-screened for. We're now learning, of course, that a lot of bone is protein. So the interaction to protein turnover in bone, which gives the bone quality rather than just bone mass, actually saves people from fractures. It makes the bone more resilient to that. So we're now finding that the protein nutrition of bone is as important as the protein nutrition for muscle. And our recent work, along with our industrial partners, has explored the same things again, the timing, the quality, the quantity that's required in order to improve bone health. And that's been extremely encouraging. So that's certainly one for the future.
From my point of view, my core interest would be in sports and exercise nutrition. And really the study that we've conducted here in a healthy aging population is probably something that has come initially from a high-performance sport environment where a lot of attention is given to protein and the timing of protein relative to training. So I think there is still a lot of lessons that we can learn for public health from high-performance and from an elite sports environment. So going forward, it would be interesting to see whether or not there are other lessons we can learn on not specifically training healthy adults or healthy aging populations as elite performance would, but looking to see how they eat and how they distribute their food in order to get the most from the training that they have achieved, and to see if we can learn lessons in this for a healthy aging population.
Pursuing the physical activity diet interaction, the augmentation, I think one of the lessons we learn is that in the continuum of physical activity course, the athlete sits at the pinnacle, right at the top. And a lot of the work that we do actually parallels from what the athlete does. In fact, we've learned so much from how the athlete is supported to respond in terms of performance, that this is now being applied into healthy aging. And it was part of our construct when we took on this contract grant award that we didn't see any particular difference between how we're treating the elderly compared to how we're treating the athlete. And we've learned so much that that has directly impacted on our work. I liken this again to Formula One racing. You know, we spend a lot of time fine-tuning and getting the best performance out of these racing cars that fly around the track. But of course, the actual main benefit to that is to the car that we drive today. In a similar way, what we're learning about the high-performance athlete has been translated directly down into the normal population. So I think, once again, Catherine's absolutely key in her position in the INDI to promote such activities. It's very interesting that the recent government policy statement, which is called Foodwise 2025, identifies the physically active person as a specific case in point, a specific population. The government obviously wished to drive the health agenda through physical activity. And of course, it's imperative, of course, that we support them in that through appropriate nutritional advice. So they actually have a designated listing for research activity in that area to 2025. And the European directive follows that up to 2030. So I think you'll see a lot more activity in this space.
Can I ask you both, though, from the personal point of view, what brought you to this particular area? Why nutrition? Why sports sciences?
It's really quite obvious. I think I was appointed as a professor of sport and exercise science. And some people think that's all just about the promotion of high-performance sport. It's not. The implications of the work we do in sport, in understanding one particular physiological challenge that occurs, is widespread. We understand how the body adapts to acute condition and how it then adapts through development of what we call the phenotype to allow us to perform for stronger, higher, longer, as the Olympic mantra goes. So nutrition supports all the activities we do. And therefore, the link between physical activity and nutrition is a very easy link. Myself, I'm a biochemist. I'm a metabolic biochemist. So I sort of understand metabolism a bit. Catherine's already mentioned this distinction between how the elderly may be blunted in a particular response. That's another subset of metabolism, to me anyway. So if we can find ways of overcoming that, what we call anabolic blunting, then clearly the nutrition paradigm for the elderly in conjunction with the appropriate physical activity for the elderly could be absolutely superb if we are to maintain healthy, active living and not to go into the decline quite so early in life.
My background is in nutrition and dietetics, and I have further qualifications in sport and exercise nutrition. For the bones of 10 years, I've worked with high-performance athletes, and that was initially how I began my engagement with the University of Limerick. It was to consult or to assist when we were setting research up from a nutrition point of view. And it was really translating the information that I would have from high performance to the research environment here and learning from the sports science and the physical activity component of it, which our training doesn't contain. So it kind of seemed like a perfect fit, that being knowledgeable of nutrition and having an interest in food and then having worked in a high performance environment and looking to see how you can optimize changes in body composition, whether it's bone or lean tissue mass or reducing fat mass, using a combination of physical activity and nutrition. You know, it's the perfect environment for me to be working in, really.
So you've been listening to Professor Phil Jakeman and Dr. Catherine Norton at the University of Limerick. This research is supported by Enterprise Ireland through the Food for Health Ireland National Technology Centre. If you'd like to find out more about research impact or to read the case study, go to our website at ul.ie/research impact.